On a dirt-covered plaza in Florence, 54 men stand, sit, and lie flat on the ground, some shirtless, but all in varying degrees of combat. Some throw punches, some wrestle, and some sit on top of others as they lie bored on the ground, sipping from bottles of water. There are fights across the field, but they're all one-on-one, independent from the dozens of men around them. Beaten and bloody, they're all clad in nearly identical sets of bright, multicolored pantaloons. In the middle of it all, one man sprints across the field and throws a ball at the wall. All around, a considerable crowd erupts in cheer. Between the fist fighting, colorful pantaloons, and Italian backdrop, it looks more like a Renaissance painting than anything else. But this is something that happens every year in Florence. This is Calcio Fiorentino. It's been a while since I put out an episode. The last two Grapevine pieces came out right before Christmas. The first was about a giant Swedish goat and the arsonists who love it, and the second focused on the unique Japanese tradition of Kentucky Fried Christmas. They're both really interesting stories, but it's been too long since I've told another. I officially published the first episode of The Grapevine about a year ago in April 2018. It was my first real foray into podcasting, and I put it out before I knew much about editing, so you'll have to forgive a little ASMR flair. If you haven't listened to it, it's called Goat Ball, and it's all about buzkashi, the official sport of Afghanistan. In writing it, I knew I wanted to tell the story of one of the strangest sporting traditions I'd ever heard of, but in researching, I experienced a newfound appreciation for the natural development of human culture. Don't get me wrong, it didn't get me closer to saddling up and getting ready to carry a headless goat across an open field, but it taught me something all the same. The story I'd like to tell is similar, and it's the first foreign sport I've researched in depth since Goat Ball. This one doesn't use any animal carcasses, but it's a game the Guardian calls the most brutal sport on earth. The New York Times calls it a most dangerous game, and Vice describes it as equal parts ball game and bare-knuckle MMA. I spent a long time trying to put together an intro that adequately describes what this game feels like to an onlooker who's never seen it before, and I think the only way to do it any justice is to give you something closer to a play-by-play. The video of the match I'll be talking about is available on YouTube, link in the description for the fans at home. So sit back and enjoy my interpretation of 2016's final match between the Santa Croce Azzurri and the Santa Maria Novella Rossi. I'm Ben Grapevine, and this is The Grapevine. Alright, so the game is starting. There are men on two sides of a field. Most of them are standing in two rows facing each other. Half of them are wearing red, half blue, some shirtless, but they're all wearing these striped, baggy pantaloons. We're mere seconds into the game, and men on both sides of the field's midline have started throwing punches at each other. If they're not punching, they're taunting. If they're not taunting, they're punching. Or kicking. The line starts to fracture a little bit as these individual fights evolve. There are 54 men on the field, but each fight is one-on-one. Men start to fall to the ground, and their opponents come with them. The game kind of looks less like a team sport and more like 27 individual wrestling matches. Every time a player goes down, the person who knocked them down lays on top of them. Honestly, if you pause the video at the right time, it's just five pairs of men hugging on the grass. Not everyone's down, though. There's some movement. People who aren't on the ground are pacing around the field, sometimes approaching and taunting members of the other team. It's not until now that it becomes particularly clear that there's a ball. Someone on the red team is holding it, and he tosses it to a teammate, both far behind the very real line of scrimmage. A member of the red team takes a drink from a water bottle, pours some into the mouth of an opponent on the blue team, who pushes him away. The red team's tossing the ball back and forth, but they're not pushing forward. There's still a lot of pacing around for both teams, with a lot of it in the middle of the fighting. Among people actively punching and kicking each other, there are guys strolling around, kind of just observing. Alternating camera angles show intense fights and groups of men standing around doing almost nothing. They're all playing the same game on the same field. We're 2.5 minutes into play. There's more punching and fighting, and more men going down. With some of these pairs, it looks like there's some real wrestling going on, but at this point, a couple minutes into the game, half of them look kind of bored. Both players in one pair look almost relaxed as they scan the field. Others fight between pinning their opponent and being pinned down, but the result sort of seems the same. Both players stay down either way. There's more fighting, and the camera pans to the red team, who seem to be advancing with the ball very slowly in a group of nine. When I say slowly, I mean it's not even really walking. It's still a sort of pacing where they kind of progress over a longer period of time. As they start to move forward, they pass a member of the blue team pinning down a member of their own team, but none of them do anything about it or even really look at the two. They keep pace walking. On one side of the field, one of the blue team's players is bleeding pretty severely from the side of his head, and a group of men in yellow shirts step onto the field to attend to him. He's still standing, surrounded by members of both teams, and he seems to be still actively taunting. A member of his own team throws some water on him, and the men in the yellow dab at the wound for a few seconds. He walks off, still in play. The men in yellow walk further onto the field and attend to a man laying on the ground. Just feet away, a pair of men punch each other without regard to what's going on beside them. The red team continues to toss the ball back and forth as the man on the ground, a member of the blue team, is placed on a stretcher and taken away. The game keeps going, but this is a big deal, and I'll get into it later. One guy runs away from one conflict in order to tackle someone on the other side of the field. The men on the red team with the ball start throwing it quicker now, jogging a little, and then they stop. They're walking again. More punching. Finally, from the skirmish, a member of the blue team sprints toward the player with the ball and a sort of fight erupts between them. The one being attacked manages to throw the ball to a teammate on the other side of the field and he takes off running. An opponent tackles him near the midline and a whistle blows. Players of both teams help each other off the ground and a green, pantaloon-clad referee throws the ball back into play. It looks like everyone's back up, but not for long, as punching matches devolve into wrestling matches. A couple of tired men grapple at each other. At some point, the red team got hold of the ball, and they're tossing it back and forth on their end of the field again. The captains of each team are clearly on the field, giving their players advice, but not playing. A player on the blue team throws an opponent over the barrier demarcating the field. He jumps back over immediately, and the referees separate them. It's hard to tell what happens, but after this brief referee intrusion, it doesn't look like the game was largely affected. Honestly, I think these guys are referees, but it's kind of hard to tell. One is wearing all green, but one's got a green shirt and red pantaloons, which is confusing. Maybe they ran out of green. There's more punching, and then at one point, about 14 minutes into the game, a member of the red team without the ball runs pretty deep into blue territory before being tackled and pinned. The refs blow their whistles, and for the first time in the game, at least the first I've noticed, a pretty big brawl breaks out around whatever just happened. Both teams have about 10 or so men surrounding the ref, with some punching and kicking. He separates them, shouts something, and it's over. Cameras pan back to the field, and we're back at it. The refs throw the ball back into play. The blue team grabs it this time, and they're much more aggressive than the reds. They run toward the midline almost immediately before retreating. That only lasts a few seconds, though, and the ball carrier, along with a few teammates, starts sprinting toward the other end of the field. He gets intercepted and tackled by a member of the red team, but throws it to a teammate just in time. He carries the ball for about a second before he, too, is tackled by the red team, handing it off to a third player who is, in turn, tackled by the red team. At this point, they're just a few feet away from the red team's end of the field. One of the blue team's players jumps over the skirmish and does a sort of flip, which takes my eye off the pinned ball carrier. I had to rewind this part 3 or 4 times to notice that he rolls the ball between the legs of a few opponents where another blue team member picks it up. Left open, he throws it to the metal fence surrounding the field, and the crowd erupts in cheers. The scoreboard updates. Red team has half a point, blue team 0. The game resets and continues like this for a while. Eventually, around 22 minutes in, the blue team acquires the ball and makes another run toward the red team's end of the field. From further back this time, one of the players lobs the ball again at the fence. When it hits, a member of the red team raises his arms in celebration and the score updates again. 1 point red team, 0 points blue. Again, the game resets and it's not until about 28 minutes in that something new happens. The red team has the ball and their players start to run forward. Surrounded, the ball carrier throws to a teammate, who evades oncoming opponents and runs toward the end of the field where he throws the ball again at the fence. The red team cheers. The score updates. 2 points red, 0 blue. At 34 minutes, the blue team does the same thing, and if you're me, it takes you this long to notice that there's a net around the field. It comes up from the padded barrier beneath it and kind of blends into the metal fence behind it. Up until that first red goal, the blue team had been missing the net and hitting the fence above it. The past two goals have hit the net directly. 2 points red, 1 point blue. Eventually, around 40 minutes in, the blue team ties it up and the game gets pretty intense. The crowd is loud, with many onlookers clinging to the metal fence or trying to climb it. Play is getting more aggressive too. In the next 2 minutes, each side makes an attempt to score almost immediately after gaining control of the ball. After a brief intrusion by the referees, the blue team succeeds. 2-3. Just 2 minutes later, they score again. After 2 more points, the red team takes a shot but misses, giving their opponents half a point. In the last 2 minutes of the game, the blue team makes 2 more rapid-fire goals, and at 50 minutes, the match is over. Fans cheer from atop the blue side of the fence, and the cameras pan to a crowd as clad in red and blue as the players. The blue team wins. So what was that? It's a sport that goes back centuries, known both as Calcio Fiorentino, Italian for Florentine football, or Calcio Historico, historic football. The game's status as a real sport is sometimes questioned, but in and around the city of Florence, it's a big deal. For a centuries-old game, Calcio's rules are pretty simple. Maneuver the ball to the opposing team's goal at all costs, save for a few key conditions. First, while punching, kicking, and tripping are all fair game, attacking an opponent from behind is strictly forbidden. Second, while there are no rules regarding what sort of maneuvers can be used in any one fight, all combat must occur between two individuals, so ganging up on an opponent is strictly forbidden. Finally, while players are allowed to pin down their opponents to keep them from moving, they can't attack someone who's already been knocked down. As long as you follow the rules and call Florence home, you can play. That's another important part of it. The history of this historical football is Florentine. If you weren't born in Florence and you haven't lived in the city for at least 10 years, you're not qualified to play. This restriction to specific geographic boundaries limits possible expansion outright, bringing us back to the question of sporthood. With participants hailing strictly from Florence and only 3 games occurring each year, it's easy for critics to allege that Calcio Fiorentino isn't a real sport, and participants don't necessarily disagree. It's not that it's not challenging, competitive, or serious enough. The game's players are dedicated to what they do. They train hard, and they play to win. To fans and players alike, though, the competition is only part of what makes Calcio Fiorentino so fiercely celebrated by the people of Florence. The rest comes from the game's alternative name, Calcio Storico. It's hard to argue against the accuracy of the name historical football, but it's ultimately important to attend to. Sure, it's an old game, but that's not at all the entire story behind the game's historical value. Once a commonly played sport, Calcio Storico cemented its historic value during the War of the League of Cognac, a complicated conflict where a number of small Italian states allied with France, England, and the Pope to fight against the influence of the Holy Roman Empire in Spain. Toward the beginning of the conflict, the people of Florence overthrew the city's ruling Medici family and founded a republic to govern the city and its holdings. Over the next few years, the Holy Roman-Spanish alliance, led by Charles V, who was both the Holy Roman Emperor and the reigning King of Spain, would slowly defeat all of the League's members one by one until only the Republic of Florence was left standing. What followed was a 10-month siege wherein the city of Florence was beset on all sides by enemy troops. It was during this siege that, in a display of internal strength to the outside invaders, the people of Florence organized an extravagant parade through the city and a particularly defiant game of Calcio Fiorentino. The Republic of Florence would eventually fall to the besieging forces and lose their war against the armies of Charles V, who soon thereafter reinstated the Medicis as hereditary rulers of the Republic. Still, despite losing the war, the Florentines would go on to view this game as a symbol of defiance against a larger enemy and of the independent spirit of the people of Florence. Today, once a year, the city's 4 Calcio teams gather for a single, simple knockout tournament of 3 games. ESPN's Paolo Bandini says it is a straight knockout with 2 semifinals and then a championship game. So even in a successful season, the most a team can hope to play is twice. Yet, according to testimonials in the same article, players practice 3 days a week for the 3 months leading up to the first match. All for 1 game, 2 if they play well enough. And still, even with these heavy requirements, there's no lack of participants. Each of the sport's 4 teams may boast as many as 70 players, even though only 27 of them can play in a match. Now, one thing I haven't mentioned yet is that this is a game where substitutions aren't allowed. So that's an upwards of 43 people who train for 3 brutal months to not play at all. The fervor for the game is so intense that even when the tournament's official prize, a cow, obviously, stopped being offered, interest didn't wane at all. Now, to be fair, a cow is a pretty weird prize to share between 70 men, and there are easier ways to earn a single steak dinner. Still, it goes on to illustrate how important this game is to the people of Florence. ESPN's piece on the sport notes that it's not uncommon to see children in Florence playing a modified version of the game, ostensibly with less brutality and maybe fewer pantaloons. The article goes on to mention that to entirely understand the cultural fire beneath calcio, it's absolutely necessary to first understand the Italian concept of campanilismo, a sort of unique, highly held local pride endemic to Italian cities. The word campanilismo comes from campanile, Italian for bell tower. It refers to the bell tower as a symbol of community. Encyclopedia Britannica explains that the patriotic spirit of campanilismo is exemplified by the boast that our campanile is taller than yours. This spirit is clearest in the structuring of the sport's four teams. Each team is identified by a color, white, red, green, or blue, but also by their association with a church, each church in turn representing a historic Florentine neighborhood. Colors identify each team on the field, but individual participants play for the name of the church, often representing the streets they grew up on. With 54 players on the field and ready for the game, the blast of a cannon marks the beginning of a match. Two teams run at each other, opening play with a straight-up brawl along the midline. ESPN calls it Red Rover with punching and tattoos. It's not a bad description. Because the game's rules disallow combat between more than two people and attacking opponents who have been knocked down, Calcio quickly becomes a game of pairs of players fighting until one can be pinned down. This line of combat forms a sort of blockade along the center of the field, and the team that managed to grab hold of the ball in the first few seconds of the game usually keeps it on their side, far from the skirmish, at least until the action dies down. When that happens, though, the game changes completely. The objective is, ultimately, to carry or throw the ball to the other end of the field and score a goal, so at some point, someone has to make a move. Once that move is made, when the player holding the ball decides to run through the contested middle ground at the end of the field, Calcio starts to look pretty similar to a game like American football. The guy with the ball tries to score while the other team tries to stop him, using any amount of force necessary. Of course, there's a pretty significant difference setting Calcio apart from more familiar sports. The guys on the ground, they're still in play. Paolo Bandini writes for ESPN, "Taking the initiative carries risk. Navigating a field strewn with bodies is not straightforward. Those fighters who have won the individual battles wait like alligators in a muddy river, ready to launch off the man they have pinned and snap into the legs of passing prey." The article goes on to list the variety of ways ball carriers have been taken down, from a knee to the spine to a pro wrestling style suplex. Having risked breaking every bone in the human body, a lucky ball carrier makes it to the goal at the end of the field, a 3-foot-tall net a few feet off the ground that runs the length of the field. Throw the ball into the net, you score a point. Throw the ball above the net, though, and the other team earns half a point. So if you're the ball carrier, attempting to score a goal means a pretty heavy risk for bodily harm, putting your team's chance at scoring in jeopardy if you get knocked down, and actively helping the other team if the ball misses the net. And this sport has a surplus of participants. Now, I'm not going to pretend to be a particularly athletic guy. I put a lot of research into this episode, and I'm not going to throw all of my credibility away that quickly. But when I talk about how dangerous this game is, I'm not exaggerating for effect. The New York Times article on the game mentions a shattered ankle, a player's ear being bitten off in a skirmish, and one man falling into a coma after taking a punch to the back of the head. So far, no one's died playing Calcio Fiorentino, but in 2013, 20% of the game's players required hospitalization after play. 1 in 5. The New York Times article goes on to talk about how exhaustion is common, made worse by the game's no substitutions rule. More than that, though, exhausting the other team is a very real strategy. In an interview with the Times, Calcio player Fabrizio Valeri says, "Trying to knock players out of the game is a very basic strategy. If we knock one out, of course, it gives us a man advantage. That can mean everything." The same article talks about strategic practices like wrapping the waist in packing tape so as to be more difficult for other players to grab onto. In recent years, players wrapping their hands has been banned after 1 year introduced a trend of players wrapping their hands in plaster. Even in this brutal game, rules like these show the sports authority has some regard for safety. Anti-doping regulations are taken with the same seriousness, with players being required to submit blood for examination. That's how one player learned he was pregnant. The game of calcio is, itself, an extreme celebration of Florence's history, but the players aren't alone in celebrating. The crowds that gather to watch the game's three matches are an important part of the phenomenon of calcio, and they take their role seriously, donning their team's colors and proudly cheering on the men who play. That's something key here, that the game of Calcio Fiorentino is more than a fun pastime for the Florentines who celebrate it. It's important. The game's final match is always played on June 24th, the Roman Catholic feast day of John the Baptist, also the patron saint of Florence. For many players, to play calcio isn't a choice, it's a cultural given. In an interview with the New York Times, a player for the Bianchi says that it is like a war. No one does it for the money. You do it because you feel an obligation to fight. And I think that's the spirit of the game. This is a high dedication activity with no salary and, after they took the cow away, no trophy. Players train for 3 months for what lasts for, if they're lucky, a few weeks. 2 games. It seems like a lot for so little, but I think that's forgetting almost all of what this game is. When the besieged city of Florence held the famed match that started it all, the result wasn't eventual glory. Florence lost the war. The morale generated by the game and its attached parade didn't translate to victory on the battlefield. But that may not have been the point then either. For the Florentines, calcio isn't a chance at wealth or glory or fame. It's a manifestation of the love and dedication they feel for their city. You have to live in Florence to play Florentine football because that's what it is, the sport that rose from the pride of the city's residents. So when some players are asked whether what they do is a sport, it's surprising to us how easily they may say no. All that hard work, all that danger, and they don't care? Not quite. What they care about is Florence, and that you understand, once and for all, that their campanile is taller than yours. The Grapevine is written and produced by me, Ben Grapevine. Thanks to Paolo Bandini and ESPN, Sam Borden and the New York Times, and Catherine Edwards for The Local. Links to those articles and the video referenced in the beginning of this episode can be found on bengrapevine.com and are more than worth checking out. Even after having it described, watching this gameplay is an experience. I postponed recording this episode for a few days because I was sick and I still hadn't fully recovered when I sat down to record it all, so I hope you'll understand that 100% of any errors in this episode are due to illness, and that I would never mess up otherwise. Being sick is also the reason I may have mispronounced any of the Italian words in this piece, including my choice to pronounce novella as a Spanish word. It's been a long time since the last podcast, but I've still got a lot of ideas and a few projects in the works, so keep checking back if you're interested in hearing more. Beyond the Grapevine, I've been throwing up some written pieces on ben.bengrapevine.com. It's mostly Game of Thrones right now, but I'll be forced to diversify soon. As always, big thanks go out to those of you who have listened to this whole episode, including this part right here, and to those of you who have listened and supported from the beginning. You're all devilishly handsome, and I can never repay you. But I'll see you next time.